We're sitting 2 years in for this January 2022's Cultivated Audio. And to quote our first guest, John Wood, our animals eat right, so you can too. John is an original board member of the Grass-Fed Exchange and moved on to processing meats at U.S. Wellness Meats, all while keeping a foot in ranching and helping many get started along the way. With over 30 years of organic farming under his belt, Dan Kittredge became a leading proponent for nutrient density in our food, and he started the nonprofit BioNutrient Food Association. And it only seemed perfect to close out this show from the cold and snowy Rocky Mountains with a reminder from world-renowned herbalist Kat Mara that an evening cup of herbal tea can really hit the spot as we imagine and dream in the spring. So grab your earbuds and or a shovel and join me for Cultivated Audio. John, in a previous conversation, one of the first things you mentioned was about helping folks who are bootstrapping their way into a regenerative system, and you came from generations of ranching. What operation did you come into, and what were you most compelled to change or improve upon?
Well, my story, I grew up on a fifth-generation farm and was involved as a small child, active in a small farm operation. We had a garden that was probably about an acre in size and produced most of our own food. And, you know, when I got old enough to help my father involved in those day-to-day activities, milk the cow every night, he milked it every morning. Went away to college and got a degree at Iowa State University in 1975 in farm operations. Came back from 1975 to 2000, involved with an uncle at a large progressive farm and cattle industry and cattle feeding, and so I was directly involved in that. Then I purchased my family farm in 1983, I guess, and I started kind of working on that project on the side. And in the early 1990s, I stumbled across Alan Savory, and I read his book and was one of the early adopters of holistic resource management, I guess. Had a class up here in 1994, and that was kind of the nucleus to start the meat company. And at that time, the cattle feeding industry was becoming more and more concentrated. We went from 5 packer buyers down to 1 packer buyer, so we didn't have much market leverage. And I had stumbled across some work out of the University of Wisconsin. Dr. Mike Parisa was a PhD student and was studying the effects of charcoal grilling on red meat. And there was a concern in the 1970s that charcoal grilling was going to create cancer.
Yes, I remember.
Potential there for what he discovered, everyone's surprise, there was something in red meat that was actually killing cancer cells. And that's not what they expected to find, obviously. Come to find out, you know, every animal is born to a mother cow, and they almost all cases are on mama's milk and grass for the first 6 months of their lives or longer. And then the majority of those animals go into a cattle feeding program, and at 14 months of age are usually harvested. However, that CLA is produced, conjugated linoleic acid, which is a magic in grass-fed meat. And we ate this for hundreds of thousands of years on this planet. All the herbivores, the beef cattle, the bison, sheep, goats, wild game in Africa, all are ruminant animals. And they produce from green grass, you produce conjugated linoleic acid in the fermentation process. And this has unique properties, fights cancer, fights diabetes, puts on lean muscle, takes off fat, and it actually is polyunsaturated, so good for the heart and circulatory system. So that kind of intrigued me. But I failed to realize at the time that 99.9% of the consuming public had no idea what that was all about. That was going to be a long, slow journey to educate people. So we had the kind of concept in 1997. We harvested the first animal, one animal. I guess we had about 10 animals, and we picked out the number one animal for a trial. And we just did it locally amongst several local families. And I didn't think it would be really fit to eat. I came out of a background where you had to feed an animal corn for 120 days in order for it to be tasty. And I just was quite skeptical. And so we harvested this animal, and the local country locker said, I think the single grade low choice. And I said, well, it can't grade low choice. It had a bit of grade. I just kind of dumbfounded. Drove over, looked at it, and you could pick it out. It had very little back fat compared to the other animals hanging up in the cooler, but it had a really nice looking ribeye. So I said, cut some steaks, and we'll compare that to a piece of prime Hereford beef that Mr. Suter, who was a co-founder of the company as well, had in his freezer. So we cooked it up on a barbecue grill one night, and we compared a steak, a T-bone, I think, and a ribeye. And we all three sat around a barbecue grill, and we all agreed that the grass-fed had a better flavor, sharper, crisper flavor. And we cut everything with a plastic knife and a fork, which is, you know, which I didn't think was possible. And we really hadn't aged it very long. It didn't have any long-term aging on it. So we were just kind of sitting there scratching our heads. And well, this is probably kind of an oddball animal that for some reason was really good. So we did a couple more in 1998 or 1999. We did six of them. And we got a little smarter. I approached Dr. Don Bites, who's a professor at Iowa State in biochemistry. In fact, I think he's still on campus 50 years now. Amazing guy.
Yes.
And he was quite excited. He said, you know, I'd love to test that for you. He said, and so we got the lab work back. This product had was really high in CLA and really high in omega-3s. Omega-6-3 ratio, I think, was like 1-to-1, which is amazing. So with that bit of knowledge, that was the decision, I guess, a deciding factor that we could maybe sell this. So we made a decision to form a small co-op, and I invited 12 people to the first meeting, and only six showed up. So we lost half the workforce and after the first invitation. But nonetheless, we proceeded in the summer of 2000 trying to figure out how to market this. We were producing 40 animals, I think, in order to try to get something ready for the fall to sell. And between November the 7th and December 31st, we had a grand total of like 45 orders, all but two people that we knew. In other words, two complete strangers that found the website and made a purchase. And then we realized, gee, this is going to be a lot harder than what we thought. We had no idea how difficult online marketing was. And this was in its infancy. In 1995 was the first really online transaction. So we were in the brave new world of online marketing, like jumping out of an airplane to 30,000 feet, trying to hope the parachute opens or you hit the ground. And we fell a long ways where we got traction. We had a little burst of traction in 2001 from Dr. Mercola in Chicago, who's the number one alternative newsletter in the world today and a good friend. And he kind of gave us a shot of energy there in August of 2001. And then we finally created some of our own niches by the end of 2003. It was a slow start. We were way ahead of the curve. And so it made us pretty astute to avoid pitfalls that could sink the ship. So we were very cautious and tried to spend our money wisely.
Yes. Now, is there an area you either made the most mistakes in or had the biggest challenges?
Oh, I'll write a book on that one. Marketing is all sorts of things. I mean, you can produce a product very well. Once you get it produced, you know, you start the harvesting process, and there's all sorts of pitfalls in that bucket. You got to make sure it's harvested properly. The animal's not under stress. Correct harvesting technique is number one. Two, we learned how to age meat. Luckily, at the very get-go, Dr. Carol Lorenzen was a meat scientist at the University of Missouri, and she was kind of a pioneer in research on wet aging, which is where you take a primal muscle and you put it in a vacuum bag, you know, ribeye or strip loin or top sirloin. You leave it set 33, 34 degrees for 30 days at a minimum. The natural enzymes in the meat will actually start to break the sinew down and flatten the flavor profile off. And that was best advice we ever had probably early on. So we were able to produce a really high quality piece of meat. That's one of the real problems in the grass-fed industry. Too many people try to harvest an animal on Monday and try to sell it on Friday. And if you go to Argentina, you'll discover they would hang things for 3 weeks, and they understood the aging process. We're lucky enough to learn that at the front end. So that was one of the good things. But you're trying to spend money to generate traffic, and you can throw money at things that don't work. And people have to have confidence in who you are and what you're doing. Trust, you know, trust, and more trust. And that's what generates sales. So one of the problems people get into, they get too much demand. So then they try to go harvest some cull cows because they're less expensive and more available, and they're coming off of a pasture somewhere. But the quality of that product will never be the same. So we've always sold under 30-month animals.
What would you say is your largest demographic for wanting grass-fed beef? I mean, it certainly has changed market-wise since when you first got started.
Well, the interesting thing about what we do and what we're trying to do, the industry is doing, is it reaches several large batches of consumers. The one you're not going to think of is that we have created a really interesting vibe into the sugar-free community. All of our sausages are sugar-free. We've taken sugar out of the bacon, and that's a huge, huge audience. I have no idea how big that one was. The soccer moms of America that understand health and wellness or read a newsletter like Mercola, there's more and more people that are in that, what I call highly educated about food categories, so they're looking for better choices, which you can't always find at the local grocery store, especially if you live in rural America. You've got to drive a long ways to find really high-quality foods in most areas of the United States, unless you're in a major city close to a whole Food or Trader Joe's, you have better choices there. So
I know, it's crazy, isn't it? Because that's where all the good stuff comes from, is the rural area.
So it's just backwards of what it should be. But then if you look at our demographics along the coast, you know, I mean, people live within 5 miles of the ocean. They're after a better lifestyle anyway, and usually have more disposable income. And so we apply to people that, you know, chosen a really fun lifestyle. Then you get into the folks with autoimmune diseases. We've hit a niche with the autism community. We've got some really clean meats, and people that are fighting illness or fighting cancer are told to try to eat a cleaner diet. And we've been blessed to get exposed to the athletic community in 2003 with some strong men, and they were astounded that they could eat grass-fed burger and they could consume 3 to 4 pounds a day. It went through them like salmon compared to wholesale grocery store product that would maybe 2 pounds a day at the max. Fed the New York Jets. We had about a 12-year run with them until the pandemic here on supplying their training table. We've fed several professional baseball teams. And these really high-performance athletes are really fun because they're always looking to tweak the diet to get a little better performance out of their bodies. And so we've worked with several training tables in the last 5 years. And it's been kind of a fun project because I think professional sports are starting to figure out too that, you know, you are what you eat. We have several employees here that feed their newborn children at 6 months of age are eating brown schwager and liverwurst, you know, as some of the first foods they feed their kids. So we actually can fall into the middle of the plate for, you know, children from 6 months of age and senior citizens, you know, trying to take advantage of the omega-3s and the CLA to fight inflammation. And so that's, it's just kind of a good thing when you come out of bed every morning and you're doing things that are good for the land, good for the animals, good for the rural community, and good for consumers in all walks of life.
Absolutely. And I'm so happy to find out about what you're doing at U.S. Wellness Meats. And you founded the Grass-Fed Exchange, and I know your focus now is more with U.S. Wellness Meats. But could you share how it helped move things along? Did it?
True founders of the Grass-Fed Exchange are Terry Gompert, who's a pioneer in this grazing industry. Tragically, he's not with us anymore. He was a great friend, great mentor, and encouraged me to be one of the early members of the Grass-Fed Exchange, I guess, in the first event we ever held. And then Wayne Rasmussen, which is a beef producer now retired in Northeast Nebraska. And those are the two real pioneers that really got it off the ground. We were starting the network already. It's been going on maybe 15 years now, but I was on the board for 9 years. But it was fascinating because we were attracting an audience from 36 to 40 states every time we had one of these national meetings. We had people in from Australia, Canada, Mexico. And then several sponsors actually contributed a fair amount of money. We were recruiting college students and high school students who had an interest. And the really exciting thing was these young people who want to be involved in this industry. And the problem is commercial agriculture, it takes millions of dollars to buy the farm machinery and to be able to play that game. But the grass-fed game, if you have a lot of ambition, a lot of energy, there's a network within the Grass-Fed Exchange and the Stockman Grass Farmers and other publication a lot of us read, and you can find producers that are approaching retirement age or internships that you can get your foot in the door. There's several great examples of people with time and talent that would approach landowners and just for the opportunity to clean their properties up, cut the brush, put the fences back in place, and put animals out there and manage energy animals from an aesthetic standpoint. Absentee landowners would just check on their property a couple times a year and see it being used to the benefit of regenerating soil. So part of the focus on the grass-fed exchange was soil regeneration. We spent a lot of time on that topic as well. And if you go back to, if you read Saber, you go back to Africa 100, 200, 300,000 years ago, there were no deserts in Africa. It was all grassland from the Cape Horn of Africa to the Mediterranean and Iraq and Jordan and you know, these upper desert areas of the African continent were sea of grass. It rained 50 inches a year in Iraq, but it fell in 3 months and 9 months were dry. Well, guess what? These large herds of herbivores, the antelopes and the zebras and the giraffes and all the things that you see in an African safari, they were in large groups. They had to live in a group, and they would eat in a group, they would dung in a group, and they would move on because they were being managed by predators, the lions, tigers, cheetahs. They would pick off the old and the young and the cripples, and that's what maintained the system. And so the carbon cycle, the natural cycle of carbon going into the soil and water going into the soil, these are all managed by God generally. You know, you could say
yes.
God ran the system, but it was an amazing story. Basically, in the Middle East and the UAE, for example, there's 200 feet of sand over what the original soil was. It's been covered now with sand. But if you go to Western Australia, what happened? Man comes along, man gets tired of being hunted by the same predators. And so man started to kill the predator population down to the point where these animals didn't have any fear. So they would not stay in a bunch, so they would spread out and graze. Well, they had over-rested plants and under-rested plants, and that's when the deserts formed. It's the over-rest and over-grazing is what created the deserts. And Saber gave a talk in 1993 or 4 here in Missouri where I first saw him speak. At that time, Somalia was in the news, a Black Hawk down, and he said, the state of New Mexico and Somalia have almost identical same climate, you know, same rainfall patterns, arid soils. The only difference is New Mexico has highway transportation, food's plentiful, people are educated, and we don't kill each other. Somalia, on the other hand, didn't have a very good transportation system. Food was always tough to come by, and there was always a battle going on. It's interesting when you think of one of the most rapidly expanding deserts in the world today, the state of New Mexico. In my lifetime, you know, the state of New Mexico has taken quite a turn for the worse. But Savory took a ranch in northeastern New Mexico, San Jose, Mexico, one of the first ranches he worked with in the United States, and he came in here in the 1970s. And he actually turned it into an oasis. All the neighbors laughed at the guy. And after about 5 years of his management, some springs started to show up where Indian campsites had been, you know, 100 years ago. And to this day, you can stand on his fence line, and on the left side is green, on the right side is a desert. People are probably still laughing at the guy, but it's just amazing what you can do when you manage the soil correctly.
It is. Earlier, you mentioned about interns. I'm sure you can relate. I interviewed Joel Salatin after he wrote his book, Everything I Want to Do is Illegal. And I'm sure you can relate to that in having worked with interns. And would you share some tips about having interns so some more folks on either side of that fence can have an easier start with it all?
Well, I think people interested in this endeavor have to be somewhat proactive. You know, you've kind of got to go find those niches. The Stockman Grass Farmer is a perfect networking tool. And then we get phone calls in here from, you know, U.S. Wellness Beats. We get a couple of calls every year from people looking for those internships. We had a student in here last year that did not come from a farm background, but he was very, very interested. And he had some access to some land. And so I've been communicating with him now, trying to figure out a niche for him. What struck me with the grass-fed exchange was how many young people have come out of the woodwork and really would like to do this. I mean, producing good, high-quality food is there's a passion for that. And that was one of the things I was amazed at, is how many young people have a passion for doing what we're doing. You can go get a job in industry and go to law school and make tons of money, but there's a certain amount of love and respect for high-quality food, and the human body's got to have the best fuel possible to actually survive in this climate we're into right now. There's a lot of madness that's gone on here in the last year. We'll stay out of that subject, but you really are what you eat and what you consume, and if you work on your own health and work on your own immune system, it's really, really vital, especially now.
Yes, absolutely. And John, I know you could add many chapters to an encyclopedia on regenerative agriculture. Do you have any last comments that you would like to chat about?
Well, what's fascinating is that when I started this project on my own family farm, it had been farmed pretty hard. The organic matter was really low. And And it just always amazed me after about the second or third year how much more forage we were producing. And then every year subsequent to that, it's continually amazing. What we're doing, though, is we're increasing the rooting depth of the plants. We've increased the water holding capacity. We've had a couple of pretty bad droughts, and my farm stays in much better shape than my neighbor's. And then we've had a couple of years where we've had tremendous amounts of rainfall, 25 inches of rain in June 2012, I think. And I've got several watershed lakes. Not once did those lakes ever go up to the emergency spillways. Every other pond in the county was running over to the spillways and pond dams. But it's just fascinating to, when you have a soil that's healthy and vibrant, what you can do with it. It's just like money in the bank. One of the things that Alan Savory did at this first meeting I saw him do in 1993, I guess, he had probably 100 people in the room. And at the end of the lecture, he said, I want you to clear half of the room. We all got up and moved. And he'd already calculated what the density was. We went from so many pounds per square foot, and we just doubled it. And then he said, oh, now I want you to go and clear 3/4 of the room. We were literally standing there shoulder to shoulder. And now we were up like 250,000 pounds per acre. You know, he had the number calculated, but that really stuck in my head. And so the more concentrated the animals are on a grazing sequence, the more benefits you get. And especially in Missouri, when we have 40 inches of rain a year, this works even faster out here in the Midwest. You do the same thing in Arizona, New Mexico, and around the country. But when you have rainfall, it really makes the system speed up considerably. It's doable. And I think if I live long enough, you'll see parts of Arizona, New Mexico, and Nevada come back to life.
And now one sentence, John, for that intern that wants to get started. What's your one sentence tip to them?
Well, they need to follow their heart, follow their passion.
Beautiful.
And feel free to contact me at U.S. Wellness Meats. I'd be glad to visit with people about that. I can point them in the right direction. They just need to be proactive. You have to make your own niche in this world, and they need to network and figure out where those niches are. But there are opportunities every summer, every season for that. And I'd be more than willing to visit with anybody that actually has an inspiration.
And John, what's your favorite steak?
Favorite steak? Oh, that's a good question. I'm kind of a New York strip junkie, I guess. I like my New York strips.
Dan, since 2016, you've been actively driving attention and research toward making nutrient density in our food a driver in the marketplace. It's hindsight, of course, but it's a big piece that got left behind in the organic movement and legislation, isn't it? And you've been focusing in both produce and meat. So maybe you can give us a little bit of history here.
Yeah, quick background about myself, but among other things, my father helped write some of the first organic standards here in Massachusetts in the country in 1986, I believe. And I asked him, why did you guys focus on a process standard, not a quality standard? Because it was about the food being better. And he said, because we didn't have any metrics. We didn't have a way of testing. So the Bio-Nutrient Food Association is an organization that I lead, and we have been working for the last 5 years, as you said, on a very broad-based project to understand the variation in nutrient levels in food. Like within this carrot and that carrot, what's the copper variation, zinc variation, 3-1, 5-1, 8-1, whatever it is, to be able to connect that to management practices, which fertility programs, tillage depth, varieties, soil types, climate dynamics were connected to those nutrient variations. And then finally, to have an instrument that anybody can use, big as a TV clicker, flash a light at the carrot or at the milk or at the meat and be able to see in real time relatively how good it is. Is it in the 80th percentile or the 20th percentile, say? Yeah, big project. And it's been going along quite nicely.
Your objectives at the Bio-Nutrient Food Association feed into the regenerative movement, and they are threefold. Would you briefly share what they are?
As I said, with this research work with the Bio-Nutrient Institute, it's define nutrient density, sort of understand the variation in nutrient levels, be able to connect it to how it's grown so we can support growers in doing a better job, and be able to test it. So anybody, a consumer, a retailer, a purchaser, a processor, everybody can make choices about what the quality is of the oats in their Cheerios or the milk in their yogurt, to be able to make decisions about food based on its nutritional value, which does connect directly to management and regenerative practices, which are agroecological and organic and permaculture, et cetera, and increase soil carbon and ecosystem function. So, yeah, when you work more well with nature in the soil, in the field, that produces food that is better for your nature. It makes you healthier. And so our thought is we can really drive that regenerative proposition, not just through carbon credits and ecosystem service markets, but through premiums based on food quality.
Is it true that you've been working mostly with produce and there's a new project for beef coming up, or how far along are you with the beef project?
We started in 2018 with our first lab in Michigan, and we looked at carrots and spinach, and then we added another lab in California and added lettuce and kale and tomatoes and grapes, and then we added another lab in France in 2020 and added potatoes and beets and leeks and Swiss chard and blueberries and apples and oats and wheat, and I think we're over 25 crops now that we've looked at. But we've looked at them from a nutritional variation perspective. So we've said amongst these 15 elements and three compounds, copper and zinc and phosphorus and manganese and, you know, et cetera, polyphenols, antioxidants, what's the variation? And we found massive variation across the board in everything we've looked at. And that was one of the questions to begin with, is how significant is that nutritional variation? And it's 2X, 3X, 5X, 10X, depending on the element. Now what we're trying to do, this is where we're starting with beef, is to be able to say, this beef is in the 80th percentile or this beef is in the 20th percentile. We've never been able to do that with carrots or spinach. We've been able to say the zinc is in the 20th percentile or the polyphenols in the 80th percentile. We haven't actually said for this whole crop, relatively, how good is it? So we started beef this past fall, 2021. We hope to have preliminary data by June or so this year, and then by the end of 2022, our first nutrient density standard or definition, first generation one for food. And beef is the one they've chosen because it's the largest global market of anything, any food stuff, and it also has the largest footprint on the landscape. So if we want to be able to drive regenerative outcomes, it's a good one to start with.
Yes. Now, let's step back into the produce for a moment, and maybe you can speak specifically to either carrots or spinach. For different landscapes, you will find different nutrients. I know you are testing in different places around the world. Are you testing organic versus commercial or conventionally grown, pesticide, chemically grown vegetables? And
grocery stores, farms, farmers markets, organic, not organic. We track all the details we can. We try to work with farmers so we can get all the specifics of what they applied, but we also work with citizen scientists who buy things off the shelf and send things in. Yeah.
And so can you give us an example of what you're finding with a specific produce?
We actually just published a chart. I think we put it out on our social media channels a couple weeks ago, which showed the variations averaged out over 8 different metrics, 6 elements and 2 compounds. And it was generally about 2-1 or 4-1 or 6-1. That was the average. A couple were, you know, were 1-1 or 2-1. Some were 15-1, 8-1, 10-1. But overall, what we're saying that means is between this carrot on the shelf and that carrot on the shelf, you could have a variation that is 6-1. As in, this one carrot will have as many of these nutrients as those 6 do. And we found that that cannot be predicted by label or market. So organic does not connect with better. Farmer's market does not connect with better. You have some actually quite good stuff that's not labeled organic in the supermarket because the growers operating on scale are doing a good job. And you've got some quite poor stuff at farmer's markets where people may be claiming to be organic but aren't doing a lot of the practices. What we found is that the variation in nutrient levels connects to the management practices in relation to life, not in relation to labels or certification
or
marketing.
Yes. And regen ag can certainly fall into the same pitfalls that organic did, because once the organic...
found that.
Yes.
You found people that claimed regenerative with very low levels of nutrients, but people that engaged in cover crops and no-till had high levels of nutrients. So the practices connect with positive outcomes. The claim or the label does not necessarily.
Right. Are you having any kind of baseline for the amount of chemicals that are used in growing these things that perhaps do have high nutrient levels still?
From all the farmers we're working with, and it's been over 200 across 2 continents and 20 crops, we're documenting all of the everything they add to the soil, all the fertility, all their management practices, like do they till, how deeply do they irrigate, do they cover crop, the variety of seed they planted, the date of planting, the soil type. So we're collecting all kinds of other information. And we've got a pretty big, you know, data explorer now, it's called, where anybody can go in there and look and search for different patterns. We are not testing for toxins because it's quite expensive. And, you know, all the work we've been doing as a charitable nonprofit in the commons is on donations. All we can do is, if the farmer applied something and they report it, we can share that. So far.
Right, so far. And then now that you're getting... Exactly. The big word there. Dan, what is involved with beef? How does it differ from what you're doing with the vegetables?
Yeah, the plant material. Our objective was to identify variations. So we only looked at 15 elements and three compounds. With beef, we're looking at over 500 compounds and dozens of elements. We want to be able to say broadly, looking at these different families of compounds, the enzymes versus the vitamins versus the lipids versus the amino acids versus the secondary metabolites, we think there's going to be patterns of balance that show up between the different families of compounds as a food gets more nutritious. And to be able to document that, we have to, you know, use more expensive equipment and run more expensive tests. So basically what we're doing right now is 200 growers globally, I guess they would call themselves ranchers mostly, are submitting three steaks, same cut, the same ribeye from three different animals. They also, before the animals are slaughtered, they submit a sample of their fecal material for microbiome analysis. And then they also submit the forage that they were eating and the soil that the forage grew on, as well as the management practices. And then we're also going to be taking about 150 samples of steak off the shelf from what we might consider to be more of a confined operation, because those are undersampled. The people who are taking part in the project voluntarily are more of the sort of regenerative growers than the confined feedlot operations.
Right. And what sort of interface do you have with the ranchers as you move into the research on beef? For instance, who decided that you would do the ribeye? Is there a particular reason why that cut of meat was used? Or is there other feedback you got from ranchers in doing this?
We mostly worked with the researchers at the universities who've been studying these things for a long time and said, what are the compounds that from all the research that's been done so far look like they're the most relevant? And what's the sort of standard in the industry for which cut gets looked at? And ribeye happens to be one that's, you know, universally looked at in the industry as the cut from which, you know, the determination of the quality of the carcass is made.
Now, tell us about your spectrometer. It's quite revolutionary. I mean, I thought I was pretty cool having a time-tested Brooks meter.
I like to say that we know what Alpha Centauri 5 light years away is made up of, not because we've been there, but because we took a picture of the light that came from it. Everything we know about the stars, about what they're made up of and things like that, comes from what's this understanding called spectroscopy, which is that every element in chemistry is a vibration in physics. So copper vibrates at a certain frequency and zinc vibrates at a certain frequency. And those vibrations are basically light. So if we can take a picture of something 5 light years away and see what it's made up of, you know, the concept is you can take a picture of something a millimeter away.
Hopefully.
So that's all we're doing is we've got 10 LEDs and a little 3D printed case and a chip, and you can take it to the grocery store right now, flash a light at 10 different crops and get readings. So it's not totally slick and user-friendly, and we don't know what nutrient density is yet, but it's a functioning prototype that shows you that you can take a meter to the grocery store, to the garden, wherever, and to your refrigerator and get readings.
So what will it show? Like if I went to my grocery store and put it in front of a kale, the kale that I'm looking at probably all came from the same place, and they might have a few different varieties of kale, but they're probably all from the same place. So what am I comparing?
What is it showing? You literally put it up against one leaf. It's like a square inch on a leaf, and you put it up against it, and then you flash the light at it three times, and it tells you what the average is.
The average
and
of what?
The readings we have right now are antioxidants, polyphenols, and BQI, which is this sort of amalgamation of six different elements and antioxidants and polyphenols. And so we'll say for polyphenols and kale, this one is in the 84th percentile of everything we've sampled so far. and we're confident to a 20% range. So it's somewhere between 74 and 94 on polyphenols or on antioxidants or on BQI. So that's what we've got so far. It only works on 10 crops, but it's real.
Right. Now, what elements? You said six elements. What are you speaking of there?
I think they're calcium, potassium, magnesium, sulfur. Don't quote me on this. Copper and zinc.
No, so you're talking the various minerals. I get it.
Yeah, yeah.
And do you bring one when you go to the store?
I don't usually go to the store, but that's because I'm a farmer. I certainly have one, and I have tested it actually out in the field.
Okay.
I tested it on my kale and stuff like that.
Right, that's a better store anyway.
Yeah. No, and I have gone to the store and tested it with the video crews and stuff like that and done that. Yeah, it's kind of fun. It's kind of fun. And, you know, we've got this whole thing with our local chapters where people do house parties, and you know, anybody who's got a meter invites their friends over, bring your shopping and a bottle of wine, and we'll flashlight at our food and have a good conversation. It's awareness raising about this whole concept that what are you eating actually, or what is or what is not in your food, and did you know that Whole Foods, the blueberries are not as good as the blueberries in Walmart, or at least they weren't in this city the 10 times it got tested, or wouldn't we like to look at our five grocery stores we buy from and see what has better or worse, or of all the farms at the farmer's market, would you like to know which one has the better quality of stuff?
Right.
I mean, I think there's some real practical implications for people.
Yes.
That actually can be the grassroots energy that inspires all growers of all sizes to do a better job.
Boy, I would be nervous to go to a store. Honestly, I'd feel like I'd walk out of the store with my head down going, well, I guess I'll get fiber.
The reality is that different stores do have different supply chains. Even if all of your fruits and vegetables are being grown in the Central Valley of California, how you manage that soil has a major impact on what's in the crop. So it's not like the same soil type has the same minerals. That's not true at all.
Of course.
You can get totally varied nutrient levels in plots right next to each other based on how the soil has been treated in the past. Yeah, just for general awareness, I think this is how these things work. It's grassroots. It's got to be meaningful to you. It's got to be visceral to you. And if it connects to regenerative actions and the climate and all that kind of stuff, wonderful.
I'm wondering, is there anything that you've done about ratio of one mineral to another? Does that come up anywhere?
That will have to be part of the answer. Or we very, very much expect nutrient density will be levels and ratios.
Perfect.
We totally expect that's what it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's not always more, it's better. 100%.
Right. So here comes the hippie in me, because I feel like once we get into the science of something, there are pitfalls that happen in scientific research, and you can measure so many things now, so much more than 50 years ago. And yet, I'm glad you brought up it's light and energy, and I feel like it's rainbows and love.
Open source.
And the love that Rancher Sam gave his cattle that's not really measurable, but that's going to make that steak taste so good.
I think it's the presence of the caretaker and the intention of the caretaker is a really important piece of this puzzle. And part of my effort in setting up a really comprehensive framework is so we can tease out all those things.
Beautiful.
So you can report this biodynamic spray you put on, or this ceremony you had, or whatever. Everybody inputs what the environmental factors were that they can capture, and then we look at the results and see what happened. If it's true that structuring water has effects, we'll see it.
Beautiful. Dan, is there something that I've totally missed out that you want to share with our audience about what you're doing over there at the BioNutrient Food Association, or something that you personally have learned through this process, perhaps?
How many minutes do I have? I feel like we each are all that we can do. The way we hold ourselves, the way we build ourselves, the way we engage the world is our piece of what the future looks like. And I think a big piece of it is literally what you build your body out of. I think it has so much to do with your energy, your groundedness, and your capacity on many levels. That's why we're focusing on nutrient density. We think it's a vector towards a deeper coherence, if I may go there.
Absolutely, it does. And it really points to the variety that's needed in our lives, right?
Of all sorts. Yes. And it's all about collaboration, right? We're a nonprofit. Everything's open source. This is only going to happen when people take it on and collaborate. So those who are compelled should feel free to reach out.
For me, one of the most magical things of growing chamomile, and it's kind of hard because to harvest it, you need that fork, the tool, because, you know, to go out and pick each head, because that's really what you want, the flower. And yeah, the beauty of harvesting it is there's this tool where you comb through the high plant and you comb off the flower heads.
And you pick those flowers really when they're full.
Correct. And so it's so funny because I love chamomile and I drink chamomile almost every night because it's such a go-to universal. It does everything. When in doubt, use nettles or chamomile. I could ruminate on how I love to look at a high quality bag of chamomile because it's all flower heads, because there's this kind of romantic, but also, you know, this intensive way of harvesting just the flowers. Now, I drink elderberry every night right now, too, and elderberry gets lots of play, but it's a great winter herb. And the beautiful thing about elderberry is you can cut a branch, put it in the ground, and you have a shrub.
What is it about a winter evening that is so perfect for a cup of chamomile tea? And maybe you can share how you brew one.
It's so funny because people think, oh, well, Briar Rabbit got it. It's not very powerful, or it's a children's tea. And chamomile is a nightly ritual for me in the sense that it's so calming. It helps with sleep. It helps the nervous system, digestion. And it's a very mild bitter. And so how I make chamomile is I don't use sweetener because I really want that bitter. But behind a good harvested, freshly harvested chamomile flower has sweetness to it. And so when you really sit in winter's lovely, whether you're looking at a fire, whether you're just pondering the day or staying warm, you know, there's so many nuances to this very, what people think is a very simple remedy. And so oftentimes at this point, it's late at night and I'll take a tea bag. When I make chamomile as an infusion, how I usually make my other herbs, it's loose tea. You don't need much of chamomile because it can be overly bitter. So this chamomile and sage, there's a few herbs that you use less of and you steep for a shorter amount of time so that that bitterness doesn't come all the way through. But chamomile, it can be cooling as a bitter. It can be cooling. So you just want to watch that. But it has this sweetness that I think is just so comforting.
Many thanks to John Wood, Dan Kittredge, and Kat Mayer. I'm Robin Clare with CultivatedAudio.com. Thanks for being here with us and for making here where we all want to be.